Mr. Evans, are you too?
Yeah, in that same battle, my steel helmet was spun from my head. A bullet struck it and spun away. And I wore that helmet all the way through, and it had this scar in it from this bullet, and I thought that was a bit of a lucky thing, so I sort of kept that. Then, of course, because the company commander was out of commission, I took over the company temporarily and was promoted captain at that time. The company was then, after a couple of weeks, was taken over by a Major Jeff Ball, B-A-L-L, and he was company commander, I was second command, and we had lost one or two officers, and they were replaced, and on we went. We then fought forward to the River Orne, actually. And we fought minor battles and took a lot of prisoners, and Germans were prisoners rushing in, put their hands up saying, "I'm Polak, Polak." They were saying they were Polish. It was a generally fluffy sort of time, really. Nothing positive, but lots of small actions. I saw one of my own officers go forward, from the battalion. He went forward in a Ben carrier, and rather foolhardy, I think. And he decided to go on and see what was happening in the front, and he got blown up by a tank. We had to sort of pull him away, and he was killed, unfortunately. But eventually we got through to near the River Orne. So the first big action in which we were involved was really a big action. And that was one where we had to take a ridge called St. Benin Ridge, which overlooked the River Orne at Touré-Harcourt.
Which ridge?
The St. Benin's, or St. Bernard. B-E-N-I-N, St. Bernard Ridge, which turned out to be very important indeed. It was the high ground overlooking Touré-Harcourt and overlooking all the area. And we were told to take this at all costs. I took a fighting patrol up during the night and managed to find a way through. It was certainly held very strongly, but I was able to come back without being detected. And so it was decided then that we would attack this St. Bernard Ridge immediately. So we went forward with the company, and we got to the top of the ridge where there was a strip of wood, and we had to fight pretty hard to get in, but we did. We captured it, but found to our surprise that in fact it was a battalion headquarters, a communication with all the communications. So we took this, but unfortunately we then found that we had an infantry company on our right flank and another German infantry company on left rear flank. So we were, in fact, cut off. And then that was quite a nasty situation to be in, and we were there for 3 days and two nights, cut off, except by wireless. We were in communication, but there was no food or any supplies coming up. Well, during that time, we were counterattacked on several occasions, and the The first morning, we were counterattacked out of the mist, and it was really quite an extraordinary experience because you saw these figures looming out of the mist, and you heard the shots going over your head, and you know, we just lay there and just potted these dark figures. They couldn't have been more than 30 yards, 20 yards, 30 yards away. You just couldn't miss them. And you just went bang and they fell, and you bang and they fell. It was just like shooting ducks, because we had our background was a dark background against the wood, whereas they were coming up over the crest of a hill in the mist, and it was perfectly simple to see them. And we fought sort of battles all the time. I climbed a tree on one occasion, and I was absolutely shocked to see that there were people who dug in with spanners only about 60 or 70 yards away, just over the brow. And we then called on the Northumberland Fusiliers through the battalion. Northumberland Fusiliers were a machine gun battalion, and they were in sight of the hill. And we were told to keep our heads down, and the Northumberland Fusiliers raked the hill with machine gun fire. And it was extraordinary, it was like being at a wedding almost, because they were hitting the reverse slope where the Germans were. But anything that went over the top skimmed into the trees about a couple of feet above our heads. And we were having streams of leaves falling upon us from this machine gun fire, most extraordinary. And in the meantime, of course, the Germans were mortaring the wood. So we had quite heavy casualties. But the climax came on the second evening when we were counterattacked from an unusual position. We're talking about August now. It was August, the corn was high, and these people attacked through a cornfield, a most unusual situation. We came under quite strong fire from a source that we didn't expect. So we called up the remnants of the company, or part of the remnants of the company, and we took them on. But oddly enough, by this time, having survived as long as we did, and having sort of fought off so many counterattacks, we were all quite confident about the situation. And, you know, we really took them on with relish almost. It really was extraordinary. We pinned them down in this corn, and I stood up and shouted, "Kamerad." I said, "Cease fire, first of all, cease fire." And then I stood up and shouted, "Kamerad." And then you saw a head pop up over the corn and another one, and I just called them in. And they came in, about 12 of the enemy there, just came in, threw their arms down, flopped down. And all this is recorded, actually, in the citation, as I just speak to you. And
the citation for your decoration?
Yes, I was decorated for that one, and so was the company commander, Jeff Ball. And we both got DSO for that particular action. And that was, in fact, the end of it. After that, everyone walked over, virtually, the river all into Tory Harcourt. While we were up there, there were one or two extraordinary incidents. We could look down into Tory Harcourt, and there was a beautiful old building there. I think it was a convent or something like that. And the Germans, the typhoons came over, our typhoons, and they sort of rocketed them, you know. So they were getting out. But as they were getting out, through the binoculars, we could see them setting fire to the place. We literally saw them actually setting fire to this beautiful old house, And when we eventually got into Tony Harcourt, they were absolutely distraught about losing this marvellous old mansion, this convent or whatever it was. And it was one thing that they always refer to. On the odd occasion that I've been back there, they always refer to this.
What did you think of the enemy in the fighting and the way in which they performed?
Well, they performed in a routine fashion, really. They really were much stronger than we were. But we had the cover. We had their trenches, the ones that they had dug, because when we took over, when we captured this central piece, we took over their defensive trenches as well. And we knew that they would counterattack, because they always did. So we were ready for them. And with these supporting arms, you know, like the Northumberland Fusiliers, and there was also artillery brought down on the edges, not on us, but I mean on approaches to the top. So we had quite a lot of assistance from outside forces, because they could see virtually see what was going on. The battle was almost rather like a film, you know, from a distance. You could see the Germans actually going into the counterattack and so on this high ground. So it was really what we expected, I think, more or less. We had quite a lot of casualties, and so did the Germans. And the account afterwards that there were 41 Germans killed in that action, and a large number wounded. The wounded we could do nothing about except to dress them with our dressings. And one poor devil German, he was in a terrible state. You know, part of his stomach had been shot away. It was, and it was really dreadful. And he kept pointing to his head, you know, indicating, "Please shoot me, shoot me." And with all the carnage that went on, and the fact that we had been shooting Germans, quite a number of them, at fairly close quarters, which didn't mean very much, because it was either them or yourself, you know, it was just a matter of surviving. When it came to doing a humane thing, like putting someone out of their agony, we couldn't find anyone to do it. It was impossible to just put your a revolver to a person's head and kill him like that, in cold blood. It was pretty dreadful, really.
So he died?
Yes, he died, actually, that one. Then, of course, we were relieved, and all the wounded were taken away, and so on. But it was quite a remarkable operation, that one.
Did you see much of the French civilians in Normandy?
Not originally. The in Normandy, if you were about to attack a place, it was usually evacuated of civilians. That was a normal thing. The civilians we did see were various farmers and farm labourers and so on. And my impression of them was we were just a damn nuisance. The Germans were a damn nuisance, and they'd settled down and they were running their farms, and now we were a damn nuisance. And we had this impression that they just stood there, you know, void of any emotion, as far as I could see. That was the impression I got from the peasants, anyway, from the sort of people who worked the fields and so on. Later on, of course, we came across the resistance and so on, and there were some very excellent people among those.
In what sense?
Well, there's after this particular battle, at Tory Harcourt, the whole division was broken up. The 59th Division was broken up at Tory Harcourt. And there is there a divisional monument to this day, of course, at Tory Harcourt. Having broken it up, we were then posted to other active regiments. And I was posted myself to the first 5th Queen's Royal Regiment. They were Lloyd Infantry, 131 Brigade, Lloyd Infantry, with the 7th Armoured Division, with the armour, the Desert Rats. And I felt more than happy to be become a member of such a famous fighting unit.
I don't understand the connection with the breakup of the 59 Div with what you were going to say about the French Resistance.
Well, only because it was after I'd joined the Queen's Royal Regiment that we really came into contact with the French Resistance. So I was trying to put it into its right sort of context. If you want an example of the French Resistance, there was with the with the Queen's, I was with the B Company, and I we went forward to the River Somme at a village called Picquigny, P-I-C-Q-U-I-G-N-Y, 8 miles north of Amiens. And we were the first troops over the Somme in this war. We all remember the Somme in the First World War. This time we reached the Somme at Picquigny, and this was after the main resistance was broken. And with the 7th Armoured Division, we in fact did about 70 miles in 2 days, which was remarkable going. We got to Picquigny. I put a platoon across a broken bridge at Picquigny, where the Somme isn't all that wide. It's not a huge river. We put a platoon across, and they held a bridgehead there while the Royal Engineers came up. And within 24 hours, we had the entire 7th Armoured Division across the Somme. Now, it was at that occasion that I first came up against resistance. First of all, there was a girl called Georgette Cavillon. And she was a very pretty 20-year-old girl who spoke excellent English and came forward and said that she was in touch with the resistance, although she was not a resistance member herself. She was in touch, she knew where they were, and that she would be very pleased to pass messages on and so on. And that girl stayed with us the whole time we were there, and we sent her on various messages across into no man's land, which she did very well indeed. And she came back on one occasion to say that there was a Sergeant Jolly Rene, J-O-L-Y-R-E-N-E, a Sergeant of Resistance, who had German prisoners, and he wished to bring them over. And it didn't want to be shot while doing that. So we made arrangements for him to come in. And he arrived with 27 German prisoners. And we had a glass of wine, and he insisted on a receipt. So I gave him a receipt for 27 German prisoners. And after half an hour, he said, "Now, may I please go back for the others?" And he went back, and he brought exactly the same number back again, 27, or maybe 37, I think. I gave him receipts for those. He asked for my home address, and some time afterwards, my wife received a copy of the receipts plus two photographs of this Sergeant Jolly Rene and a description of the battle. I still have all these things if you actually. But it just shows, I think, that the what a different war this was from the First World War. It was across the other side of Bikini that we came across the first V1 rocket sites, and I have photographs actually of those that were brought to me by the same girl, Georgette Cavillon, who has kept contact all the way through. She married an American officer, eventually became Madame Gorman. She went to America. She came back. She still lives in Bikini now. In fact, came back to this house here only 3 or 4 months ago and brought photographs then of these particular V1 sites and various other things. And she telephoned me, as a matter of fact, last week to say that the mayor of Bikini was writing to me to ask me to go over officially on the 50th anniversary. I think they wanted to have it on the 4th of September, which is a week or two after the actual liberation. I still haven't received it, but I understand it's on the way. So,
what did the V1 sites look like?
Well, they were just crude tracks. They were in the woodland, the trees all around, and they were built at an angle, rather very much as you would expect them to be, so that when they were fired, when the rockets were fired, they went up a ramp and straight into the air. So they were quite crude things, on rails, actually. I've got photographs here. But, of course, that was exciting for us because the V2 and the V3, the V1 and the V2 rockets were very serious problems at that time. And that was the beginning of us reaching the... So that was Bikini.
And then?
Well, from there we fought various battles. You don't want me to go into detail with every small battle that we fought. Some of them weren't as small as that. But the next event of great consequence, I think, was our entry into Ghent.
Was this the liberation of Ghent?
The liberation of Ghent, yes. Now, we hadn't seen many civilians up to then, but they came to an arrangement with the Germans that the Germans should retire to the north of the city so that the city could be occupied without being destroyed. And we sailed in, 7th Armoured Division, Lloyd Infantry, all on lorries or some vehicle or other. And we went through streets thronged with shouting, excited people. Thought the war was over. They were throwing flowers up onto the vehicles. They were throwing bottles of wine up. They were kissing as many men as they could get hold of. We went into the centre of Ghent, where the churches are, where the commanding officer said, you know, for God's sake, take those heads from the civilians, get the men away from the civilians, we have work to do. And each company was given an area to occupy. And mine was on a bridge to the north of the town. And as we went from the centre to this bridge, so the crowds diminished, and eventually we were going through empty streets. And we reached this particular bridge called Phoenix Bridge, I remember, and established ourselves there on one side of the canal, and the Germans were the other side of the canal. And that was a very interesting period. It was about the Any time we'd stopped for about, I think we stayed there for 5 or 6 days, during which time I was promoted to major and commanded the company. The area was rather unusual because we were able to cross the canal in some places without much difficulty, but in other places they were being held by the Germans. And a man called Gustav van Boxtel, a Belgian officer, in civilian clothes, of course, at that time, came to me and he said, if I can be of any utility, I'd be very pleased to help. And it turned out that he was a lecturer or professor at Ghent University. He had been in the Belgian army, and he was by way of being quite a good artist. And so I asked him if he would look after all the hundreds of people who were coming in, giving information on where the Germans were and registering complaints and so on. And he did that. And for 5 days he was there, and he was a tower of strength because he spoke German. He spoke French and the Belgian language and English and so on. So he was a tower of strength, Gustav. And on one occasion, I went over the canal to meet his wife and son, and they were actually in the German occupied zone, but only half a mile or so inside. And he was well aware of where the Germans were from the information he was getting. So I went over and I spent some an hour or so with his wife and son and so on. And at that time, I saw a painting, which was very nice, a still life painting. I admired it. And he said, oh, yes, well, that's one of my paintings. And it really was an excellent thing. And I liked it very much. The reason I tell you this is because there's a sequel to this. Anyway, we came back and we decided, he decided that he would like to stay with me. Now, I was an infantry company commander, and we were into battles all the time. I mean, it was either defense or attack all the time. But he volunteered to come with me. And such was the position in those days that I said to him, well, we can't put you officially on the strength. And if anything happens to you, by hard luck. And he said, well, that's all right. I want to come. I want to do my bit. So I gave him, I made him a lieutenant, unofficially. I made him a lieutenant. I gave him a lieutenant's uniform. He was there. I took him and I showed him to the commanding officer of the battalion, who was Colonel Ian Freeland. Later, he was commanding the troops in Northern Ireland. Ian Freeland said, well, this is very unofficial and so on, but I said, well, I'd like to put him on the strength, on the ration strength and so on, if he insists on coming, and he will be of great help. So that was agreed upon.